Tracy, everyone. And let's jump in. Okay. Welcome to Monday morning. We're going to be looking at a piece of Vayikra on this week's Parsha, Parshat Emor, which will focus, is one of a series of excerpts from Vayikra that focuses actually on the lighting of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash and tries to derive meaning from that. Let's look at the psukim for a moment. Just going to make this a little bigger. There we are. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the Israelite people to bring you clear oil of beaten olives for lighting, for kindling lamps regularly. Aaron shall set them up in the tent of meeting outside the curtain of the pact to burn from evening to morning before the Lord regularly. It is a law for all time throughout the ages. He shall set up the lamps on the pure lampstands before the Lord to burn regularly. What the Midrash is going to be doing today is jumping in, not specifically focused on these psukim as it often is. That's because the previous excerpts in Vayikra Rabbah that we're not looking at today have already done that, but centered around this idea of light in the Beit HaMikdash, and we'll see how it does that. We are looking at an excerpt from Vayikra Rabbah 31:7 for people who are following along at home in your own books. A little bit about one thing I want us to keep in mind. We are going to be getting two different explanations of how light comes into the world. Two very powerful, I'll say, metaphors. I want us to keep track of our own reactions to each of these metaphors if we really dive into them and imagine that this is how light comes into the world. What reaction does that evoke in us? Which do we find ourselves more attracted to? And what do we think each is trying to evoke in us religiously? Let's jump in. Rabbi Chanina said, there were windows in the temple and light would go out from them to the world, as it is stated in 1 Kings 6:4. And for the house, he made windows broad and narrow. They were broad and narrow, narrowing on the interior and widening on the exterior so as to give out light to the world. Okay, let's pause for a moment. Rabbi Chanina is focusing on the odd wording in the pasuk, broad and narrow. How can windows be both broad and narrow at the same time? And his answer is, it actually has to do with the difference between the windows on the inside and on the outside. On the inside, on the interior of the building, they were narrow, but as they went to the outside of the building, they became wider. And he's saying that actually that gives off light into the world. I like to think of it as the way a bullhorn works. The bullhorn is narrower by your mouth, but broader on the outside so as to broadcast your voice to the world. This is broadcasting light to the world. And just to make sure we pick up on the thematic link to this week's parsha, we've jumped in from psukim that are talking about the Kohen Gadol making sure that there is light in the Beit HaMikdash to this idea that, well, in the Mishkan, in what we have in our psukim, to this idea of the Beit HaMikdash when it's finally built by Shlomo, giving off light into the world. Let's keep going. Line 2. Rabbi Levi said, there is a relevant parable of a king who built a palace for himself and made its windows narrowing on the exterior and widening on the interior to bring light into it. But the windows of the temple were not like this. Rather, they were narrowing on the interior and widening on the exterior so as to give out great light. Rabbi Levi is pointing out that usually you want windows to work in a different way. You want the windows to be bringing in as much light as possible. And Rabbi Levi is pointing out that what is actually different here is that the Beit HaMikdash does not need to rely on outside light. The Beit HaMikdash, instead of taking in light from the world, is generating its own light. Sharon Perlman pointed out that I think ramparts are smaller inside and larger outside for protection. Yes, I learned that embarrassingly enough, from reading Ivanhoe rather than from any history class, but very, very astute. And here, what we're actually doing is flipping that. Rather than saying this is for the protection of the people inside, we're making it into a metaphor and saying it's for the enlightenment, literally, of people outside. So let's pause for a moment. Image one that we've been given is that the Beit HaMikdash actually, through these windows that widen as they go to the exterior, gives light to the world. Where does light in the world come from? It comes from the Beit HaMikdash itself. Let's take a moment just to pause. What sort of feelings does this evoke? When you imagine the idea of light in the world coming from the Beit HaMikdash, what sort of feeling does that evoke in you? What's the Midrash trying to do for us emotionally so far in giving us that image? Let's use the chat. Arlene Berger says, reminds us that God is not located in just one place, but presence is everywhere. Good. So there's a centralization of God's presence in one place, but being given out into the world. Susanna Levin says, it's not a physical light. Absolutely, but definitely a very powerful metaphor for sure. Sharon Perlman, God is spreading God's warmth on everyone like a loving blanket. Ooh, wait a moment until that. Wait one moment, because the Midrash is actually going to take that to a bit of a wilder place, but very much using that image. Oh, Zoe Lang, the temple has a unique light and doesn't require light from the outside, unlike the king's palace. Great, and is determined to share that light with the world. Adina Bromwitz, God is a creator of light, first creation in Bereshit. Great, so let's just recap a little bit of this. In this image, what's being reinforced for us is that God's presence is in the world at large, but concentrated most in the Beit HaMikdash. That is the centralized place of God's presence. And from there, in this very domestic image, I want to point out, of actually going out through windows. That's how light emanates into the world. This is an image of, I'll say, a centralized God, a God who very much dwells in the Mikdash, and maybe a little bit of a domesticated God. If we remind ourselves of the image that brought us into this Midrash in the Psukim of Aaron lighting the menorah, there's something a little bit domestic about that. Make sure that the lights are on. Make sure that the windows are the proper width. That's how light emanates into the world. Let's go on to the next part of the Midrash. One thing I want us to know, what we're about to enter in the Midrash is actually a core that seems older than lines 1 and 2. We've talked about before how Vayikra Rabbah seems to be a little later than some of the other Midrash Rabbahs. For example, it's almost certainly later than Bereshit Rabbah. And what we're about to see in line 3 through the end appears in Bereshit Rabbah as its own section. I think that what happens for us is by putting lines 1 and 2 together with it changes the meaning of the Midrash a little. And we'll see how that happens. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzadak asked Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, since I have heard about you that you are a master of Agadah, of homiletics, from where does light come out to the world? We know that in the Pshat of Bereshit, God creates light and that's it. But what the question here seems to be, how does light continue to go into the world? Is there some sort of action that renews it in some way? He said to him, the Holy One, blessed be he, wraps himself with a garment, and all of the outer world shines from the splendor of his glory. He said this to him in a whisper. Okay, so what we're getting here, the answer is very different from the first answer that we've been given. What is the action that actually causes light to emanate out into the world? It actually is God donning some sort of a garment, which is a bit of a startling image, And then from there, the light goes out into the world. The way that I picture this is when people put on a tallit every morning, they wrap themselves with it around them and then sometimes do this very abrupt motion when they take it off or when they put it on their shoulders after having it over their head. I imagine this as that motion where it's taken off over your head as the light being given off. And one thing that's important to notice here is that the answer comes in a whisper. Why a whisper? You can use the chat. Why would this be something that needs to be said in a whisper? Sharon Perlman says it's a very personal, intimate way of addressing someone. Do you mean the action of the dressing and the undressing, the garment? The whisper. Interesting. So there's something actually that is not about the content of the message has to be secret, but it has to be conveyed in such a way that it forms a personal bond with the information, with the person that the information is being conveyed to. Francine Shaga said not to break God's focus. So you're actually imagining them almost looking in this moment on God doing this and a whispered description happening. That's really beautiful. Rosemary's mystical concept not meant to be shared with everyone. Great, there's a concept that there are certain things about exactly Sophie Masebreshit, the way that creation happens, that cannot be discussed in public. So I actually want to make sure that we focus in on two of these. One, the idea of the secrets of creation. And two, there's something very intimate happening here, both between the master and the disciple, but also with God. This dressing of God, God's self, actually seems to be a very intimate moment. Let's keep going in the Midrash and see what the Midrash does with that. Rabbi Shimon responded to him, "It is an explicit verse, as it is stated in Psalms 104:2. Wrapped in a garment of light, you spread the heavens like a tent cloth. And you say it to me in a whisper?" Rabbi Shimon is saying, if that's your answer, we actually have an explicit pasuk, an explicit verse that says as much. Why are you whispering this to me? It's not a secret. It's actually something that is stated straight out in Tehillim. Some of us will recognize that pasuk from Barchi Nafshi Et Hashem. And I want us to focus on one particular link here. If you looked at that pasuk and you had to make a jump to this midrash is somehow going to connect this to either the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash, what word would be the hyperlink there? Great, so rafters definitely comes up. Just in this particular pasuk though, tent, great, Sharon Perlman. If you use the concordance to look up Yiriyah in all of its forms, and again, I'm going to plug alhatorah.org, I believe it's possibly .com, they have an amazing concordance tool. Almost 90-something percent of the instances of the word Yiriyah happen in Shmot, and they happen referring to the Mishkan. So that's going to be our hyperlink that will bring us back to this greater idea of discussing the Mishkan. Let's keep going. The last thing we saw is the seeming outrage at why do you have to whisper this? This is an explicit pasuk. Line number 6. He said, "In the same way that they said it to me in a whisper, so too did I say it to you in a whisper." So the answer is, I know that this is an explicit pasuk, but you have to understand that there is actually a tradition here that is maybe separate from the pasuk of how this information needs to be conveyed. And I'm trying to look back exactly as Sharon Perlman said, it needs to be conveyed in a very intimate way. And there's something here that is a little bit more sensitive than you might think simply from reading the pasuk. It's giving us a hint that there's something here that is a little bit, I would say, private, a little bit, maybe even wild. And we'll come back to that towards the end. Line number 7. Rabbi Barachia said, "Were it not that Rabbi Yitzchak expounded the above teaching in public, it would not have been possible, permitted, that is, to say it." Rabbi Brachia is taking this even further. If it weren't, it's not only that this teaching was conveyed in a whisper, it's that there is something here that is so outrageous that if someone in the previous generations had not taken upon themselves to teach it in public, we would not be able to bring ourselves to say it. For all that it's an explicit pasuk, this would have somehow been dropped from the tradition, at least in what we teach publicly. And I want us to hold in our minds, as we come to the end of this midrash, why? What is it about that concept that's so outrageous that we actually have this discomfort with it almost? And before that, what would they say? Before Rabbi Yitzchak expounded it in public, what would they say in answer to the question of how light emanates to the world? Rabbi Brachia said in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, from the place of the temple, from there light goes out into the world. What we started with, the idea of the windows of the Beit HaMikdash, that they would bring light out into the world, that was the teaching of how light came into the world before Rabbi Yitzchak said yes. Rabbi Yitzchak said this in public, that was actually how light came to the world. Not God donning the garment and spreading it out, but light coming from the centralized place in the Beit HaMikdash. This is the understanding of that which is written in Ezekiel. And there, coming from the east with a roar like the roar of mighty waters, was the glory of the God of Israel, and the earth was lit up by his glory. And his glory is nothing besides the temple. As you would say, throne of God exalted from old, the place of our temple. So we have in this pasuk in Yechezkel, the earth is lit up by God's glory. And then this other pasuk in Yirmiyahu, where the place of our temple and the glory of God are synonyms. So we are doing just a little bit of math here, basically. If glory of God equals temple and glory of God lights up the world, it is the temple that lights up the world. Now, the question we wanted to come back to, now that we've reached the end of the Midrash, is what is it about this teaching about God lighting up the world when God puts on God's garment that is so, I would say, controversial? What is it about that teaching that's so wild that it actually has to be in some ways limited or suppressed? And how does it play against this idea of light emanating from the Beit HaMikdash? We talked a little bit about what feelings the light coming out of the Beit HaMikdash to the world evokes in us. Let's take a moment to look at the piece of Tehillim that our pasuk about God putting on the garment comes from to see what feelings that image evokes in us. Great. This is from Mizmor Tehillim, Kuf Dalet 104, and I'm going to read a little. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed in glory and majesty. These are our key words. Wrapped in a robe of light, you spread the heavens like a tent cloth. He sets the rafters of his lofts in the waters, makes the clouds his chariot, moves on the wings of the wind. He makes the wind his messengers, fiery flames his servants. He established the earth on its foundation so that it shall never totter. What we're getting here is we're getting a lot of architectural imagery, but we're getting architectural imagery not in the very domestic sort of way that we do in the Beit HaMikdash, where windows are actual windows and rafters are actual rafters. But what we're getting here is, you know what God's rafters are? His rafters are the heavens and the clouds. You know what God's tent is? God's tent is the entire heavens. You know what God's robe is? God's robe is all of the light in the world. What's the Midrash doing by bringing this into conversation with the actual Beit HaMikdash? How do these two play against each other? What gets highlighted in the juxtaposition of this Mizmor of Tehillim with verses about the Beit HaMikdash? You can use the chat to answer. And again, this is why, for those of you who are teachers, You have no doubt spent a lot of time making sure that your students look up the context of the psukim in every midrash. What is the midrash accomplishing by putting these two into conversation? Erlene Berger says, "To me, it's a message for the exile. God is everywhere. Great, we don't have the Beit HaMikdash anymore, but you know what God's rafters are? God's rafters are the heavens. You're worried about where is the light in the world going to come from? The light of the world comes from God, God's self, spreading out God's garment." Ellen White, "Since people built the temple, we are vehicles bringing light into the world." Great. This juxtaposition actually does something pretty wild. This juxtaposition says God created the world, the rafters and the, what else was it, the tent and the garments that God wears. You've been given an ability to actually do something that's parallel to that. God will willingly consign God's self, even though God fills the whole world and the wildness that's contained in all of that, to this little domestic building. On the one hand, where does the light of the world come from? God, the light of the world comes from God, God's self, which is uncontainable. And if you have a chance, I would really suggest that you take some time to read through the whole piece of Tehillim in the English and really take it in for how, I keep using the word wild, but I can't really get away from that word. It is if you take that imagery seriously. On the one hand, that is true of God, we're saying. And on the other hand, God is willing to let God's self be consigned to this building with man, with human-built windows, where a human being lights the lamp every day. And those two somehow live together. Francine Shraga says, "To everyone, Beit HaMikdash equals world and vice versa." Great. So this parallelism, these two have to somehow play together. They almost depend on each other. Here's where I want to leave us, because we're about to run out of time. Sharon Perlman says, "Psalm 104 is a transcendent God. God in this midrash is immanent." Beautiful. And let's actually dive in there in our last few minutes. This midrash is doing a little bit of the work for us here. This midrash is saying we have two very strong ways of understanding God. We have the uncontainable God, the God who fills the entire earth and more, the God who creates light simply by kivyachol, if it were possible, putting on a garment, the God who creates everything and rides on the waves. And we have God who consigns God's self to the Beit HaMikdash. And somehow both of these need to live together. And the Midrash, I think, is actually doing us a little bit of a favor here. The Midrash is actually saying, in order to really access the immanent God, the God who is contained in the Beit HaMikdash, the God who, as all of us are absent from our shuls every Shabbat right now, and the light that emanates from those, the God who's present in those spaces, sometimes you have to almost wrap in parentheses in your mind the wilder God, the God who fills everything, because it is so difficult for a human being to imagine both of these at once. But don't forget, even as you wrap that in parentheses, that whisper that that God is still who God truly is as well, that transcendent God. And the Midrash is almost helping us develop an emotional framework for how to hold both of those at once. This is the truth that we speak in our day-to-day lives, this immanent God, the God who is in our homes, in our shuls, in the Beit HaMikdash. But keep that whispering voice in your mind so that you never forget about the transcendent, wilder image of God. Let's take a few minutes now at the end for reactions over the chat, if anyone has any last thoughts. Melinda Zalman says, "Light emanates throughout the whole world rather than through the centralized place, i.e., from the center of Jewish worship. In other words, God's light is accessible equally to all rather than only through Torah." Great. And the challenge of someone who lives their life through Torah and wants to access this God, the God who is both of these things, is how do I emotionally and intellectually keep both of these? What do I have to do to center my life living through Torah while keeping in mind that God is actually accessible to all? Francine Shraga, wilder, i.e. beyond our knowing or understanding. Great. I wish that I had had that little sentence earlier. I could have used some of that instead of simply saying wilder over and over again. I think that's exactly on point. Okay, we're going to wrap up here. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning, everyone. As always, it's really great to see you, and I'm really happy to see some familiar faces. I hope that this is the beginning of a great week. Brachot and health and happiness to everyone.